Welcome to the V-Wave Podcast. This podcast is brought to you by River Runners for Wilderness and is created by a cast of river lovers who understand the river resource comes first. On the shoulders of a healthy river do we recreate ourselves. What comes second is river access, a very thorny V-Wave, all in itself. The V-Wave discusses these things and river ecology, recent river trips, river history, river management, and new changes on rivers. Have a topic you'd like to hear more about or help discuss? Get in touch with me, your host, Tom Martin, at rrfw.org. That's T-O-M-M-A-R-T-I-N at rrfw.org. Special thanks to Shar and Trev, who came up with this idea. Welcome to another V-Wave podcast. Today's podcast I'm titling Rain Moves Rocks. And this is about ever-increasing frequency of storm cells over the Grand Canyon that cause side canyon floods or more potent debris flows, or simply rocks raining off cliffs down on river runners. And this isn't just applicable to Grand Canyon, it's applicable to the San Juan or to Cataract Canyon or Desolation Gray or Yampa. Name your river that's got cliffs and rain, and there you go. Yesterday, about 30 people met at the U.S. Geological Survey campus in Flagstaff, Arizona. About six people were online there. And a gentleman by the name of Paul Grams that works for the USGS had a meeting from 1 to 5 o'clock in the afternoon that was just really dynamic, that spoke to some very interesting things on this issue. And welcome today to Paul Grams.
Thank you, Tom. Yeah, my name is Paul Grams. I'm a research hydrologist with the U.S. Geological Survey in Flagstaff, Arizona. I'm with the Grand Canyon Monitoring Research Center. I typically work on how the operations of Glen Canyon Dam affect physical resources, sediment resources, mainly sandbars, camping beaches along the Colorado River and Grand Canyon, but have gotten involved in this project that Tom just mentioned as kind of a new thing here that we're working on.
So, Paul, could you give us just a real brief synopsis of your background, how long you've been working for GS, and working on specifically looking at Glen Canyon Dam impacts to downstream resources? And where'd you grow up?
We can start with that. I grew up in Minnesota, so I grew up not so much on rivers, but paddling lakes and lakes in northern Minnesota in canoes.
Wait, that's the boundary waters, isn't it?
That's right.
Yep. Oh, my gosh. Lucky you.
So, yep, I grew up, really a different kind of water-based trip, but doing that all through junior high and high school.
Nice.
And then got introduced to rivers, working on rivers, when I was in college with Jack Schmidt, who is a name I'm sure many of the listeners are familiar with here. So, yep, I was introduced to the... And in fact, Tom, I think you and I were on my first river trip together.
Okay.
Now that I think way back, January 1990. Well, we weren't on the same trip. I was on a Middlebury College trip in January of 1990, and I believe you were on a trip led by Bob Webb that overlapped with us.
It's possible. I mean, it might have been Ted Mellis doing a debris flow survey up in Crash Canyon.
They were doing a Stanton refotography trip.
Okay.
I think you were on that.
I'm not sure.
It's
maybe
a long
not.
Time ago.
It's a long time ago. Yeah.
Anyway, so I was introduced to working on these rivers ages ago and have been working on them ever since. So I did some undergraduate work working on the Snake River, graduate work working on the Green River downstream from Flaming Gorge Dam and Dinosaur.
Okay.
And have worked... a little bit in Grand Canyon throughout that early period, and then ended up finishing graduate work and getting a job with the USGS in 2008, and have been here in Flagstaff since 2008, working in Grand Canyon.
Nice. And how did this program come up? And what's the name of the program that we're looking at now that the meeting was about yesterday?
Well, we titled our project "Risk to Campers on Tributary Debris Fans at the Colorado River in Grand Canyon from Debris Flow Hazard," and that's the title we came up with. We put on our proposal, so we submitted a proposal for just a little bit of funding, basically $50,000 to cover some salary and some travel to the USGS Risk Community of Practice Program. So, you know, USGS is a big agency. There's a lot of different things, and one of the things that goes on are these sort of USGS-wide, I guess you could call them initiatives or programs, and there's a complete hazard mission area, which contains scientists and researchers who really focus on hazards like earthquakes, you know, volcano hazards, flood and debris flow and landslide hazards.
Okay.
And those are people who work on that stuff full time. Hmm. But then they also have this kind of focus group called a risk community of practice that is meant to, as a way for people that work anywhere in the USGS to kind of connect and share experiences, and a way for people who maybe don't work on that stuff all the time to get involved. And
nice.
So we kind of got involved that way, in the sense that they put out a call for proposals that we responded to. And the focus of this isn't really to, with this initial one anyway, isn't to do new research or come up with new data on debris flows or flash floods in Grand Canyon, but to really start a process of connecting USGS science with stakeholders and with public need.
Okay.
So that's why the idea is that rather than collecting a bunch of data, you maybe should start a project by getting together with people who might be interested in the data and who might need some of the information, and start with that kind of approach, as opposed to just collecting data before you know what people really are interested in, what they need.
So how did the meeting go yesterday for you? Can you kind of tell us sort of what happened during the meeting, and then your thoughts afterwards?
We were really happy with how the meeting went. Like you said, we had about 30 or so people, and we had people from groups that we work with a lot, which are some of the river running folks, commercial river guides, folks from the National Park Service, from Grand Canyon National Park. But we also had some people that we've essentially never worked with before, which are people from emergency management, the Coconino County Emergency Management, the National Weather Service, the people who issue warnings for weather-related hazards.
Mm-hmm.
And within the park, you know, people who work on more hazards-related things. So it really brought in a different set of people than we usually work with. And we started off with just explaining this project, more or less what I've just described to you guys here, and telling people that, you know, where we are in this project. And then we presented some preliminary data that we had. Well, actually, a preliminary analysis of existing data. So back, you know, in the 1990s, kind of ending with some publications around early 2000s, a study group, a USGS group that was led by Bob Webb at the time, and Ted Mellis was part of that group, and Peter Griffiths, who's still with the USGS as an administrator, did a study on debris flow frequency. And so they produced essentially a map. You can think of it as a map that's a prediction of debris flow frequency for pretty much every tributary that intersects with the Colorado River and Grand Canyon. And that was based on historical data, so observations from the 1890s through the 1990s, mostly repeat photography information, historical accounts, and some dendrochronology records, so tree ring scarring records.
Okay.
So when a debris flow hits a tree and beats it up, it heals over, you can core that and count rings and estimate when that injury to the tree happened.
Got it.
So with that kind of information, they came up with an estimate of debris flow frequency for these tributaries. And we just did a simple exercise of looking at how that frequency intersected with known camping locations, so essentially campsites along the river. And so we could say, okay, what's the estimated frequency of debris flows that would impact campsites? And we presented that information, and I think that's certainly not really a camp here, don't camp here kind of information. It's just a piece of information that might be of interest to people when they're looking at potential campsites. So we presented that, and then we just asked for feedback. We broke out into breakout groups and got feedback for ideas on how to communicate flash flood and debris flow risk to the public, and what the boating public really might really find most useful in looking at that.
And what were the four breakout groups?
We had a breakout group focused, and we gave the same charge to each of the breakout groups, which is really just we asked them to, what did we ask them to do? We essentially asked them to, what kind of actions or things should we do to elevate awareness and communicate risk to visitors to Grand Canyon? That simple question asked each of the groups, and we had a group comprised of people from emergency services, which was kind of the search and rescue people, the alert people, National Weather Service. We had a recreation group, kind of people coming at this from a recreation standpoint, so that would be the river guides, private boaters, your group. Let's see, we had a group that went at it from kind of the mapping analysis angle, so people focused on sort of producing map products, and then we had a group that kind of represented scientific communication and community outreach.
And with these four groups charged with making a list of action items to
yep.
to help elevate the park's understanding of the risk and what to do about it.
Yeah.
What did the four groups kind of come up with?
Well, there was a lot of ideas. I think, interestingly enough, what we did is each group came up with as many ideas as they wanted, and we asked them to present their kind of top three ideas when we came back together to the large group. The group that suggested we needed a PR campaign that included swag, namely stickers and beer koozies that somehow communicated the debris flow flash flood risk, I think got the most votes in the end as a way to, connect with the public and elevate outreach. Of course, mm-hmm. the idea with something like that is it's not just a sticker, but a sticker that maybe then connects to another source of information. And, one of those sources of information would be some kind of either a sign or a flyer, a website that conveys some of this risk information about where and when floods are most likely to occur, essentially. But I think the other thing that people really keyed in on a lot was developing some kind of a warning system, taking advantage of the huge increase in the utility and availability of satellite-based texting devices.
Right.
So I think a lot of people were interested in a way that there could be weather alerts, just like we get here when there's a storm cell hitting a drainage that might impact a community where people live. If they could get a text on a inReach that told them that there was an intense storm cell likely to impact a tributary drainage to the river and what river mile range that might be impacting, people would find that useful.
Right. So I'm familiar with living in Flagstaff here in a floodplain below a fire scar. The National Weather Service, through the county or in conjunction with the county, puts out an alert when there's a storm over the watershed above the house, and I pay attention to that and go out and look online at what the rain gauges, say. Would it? Mm-hmm. Are you thinking? Yeah, you know, just broad brush and not holding it any. You know. Oh well, you said. Would that be the sort of messaging concept? Is as you say with inReach, the spot devices, the ability to text to a satellite back to a website somewhere, or an email, or a cell phone back home. That could be based out of some sort of sign-up system that was operated by someone somewhere that would just beam out where these storm cells are?
Yeah, I think so. I'm not the technical expert on how exactly it would work. But one thing I do know is it wouldn't be quite like the current cellular-based messages people get, because sometimes those are directed to specific cell towers. So that way they send a message in a location-based way.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
But this couldn't do that, because it wouldn't know where you were. Well, it would be just texting to a spot device. It would just be sending this to whoever subscribed, and it wouldn't matter where they were. So,
which might have merit, especially for people who are interested in rain events in the Grand Canyon. I know that you've just explained why. When I left town, I stopped getting these alerts, even though I knew that, you know, there was trouble back on the home front, because I was out of that specific cell tower service. Now, there is no cell tower service throughout the greater Grand Canyon. A lot of service in certain areas, but clearly, as you say, this would have to be satellite-based.
So, but the message itself could contain site-specific information. So it could be a list that storm cells are expected to impact, this, River Mile, 87 to 110 or something like that, or something like that.
You bet.
It could just be a list of river mile ranges that are expected to be impacted. It could be more specific, maybe, or it could be, it could list drainages. That would be something that I think would, a system like this would be implemented probably by a group of people from the Weather Service, the Coconino County, and the Park Service.
Sure.
And then maybe probably with some feedback or input from us on how to set that information up.
And it would, I suppose it would make sense to look at, and somebody did mention this yesterday, I forget whether it was you or someone else in your team there, about an alert 2 days out. You know, the forecast in 48 hours is for storms in this area.
Yep.
A 1 day out or a 2 hour out. Of course, if these things happen in the middle of the night, which is not unheard of, everybody's going to be asleep.
Yep. And I don't know. I mean, it's possible, there is, I think there is existing weather information that can be, people can subscribe. I don't actually have one of these devices myself, so I'm not super familiar with it, but
yes, there is.
You can subscribe to some basic weather info, right?
And that is a very popular function. It's a very popular function.
And who knows? It might not be too long before. I'd hate to say it, but the whole internet's available wherever you are. So, who knows?
Right. again, we need to remember that Grand Canyon National Park, 90% some of the park is a. Managed as a potential wilderness area, and so it's the visitor's responsibility to be responsible for their own journey, and if they want to stay connected, they can. If they want to disconnect, they can. And there you go. From swag to an inReach announcement. That's pretty neat. Do you think this having possible expansion ability through more of the? Up into Flaming Gorge. Well, of course, the ABC section below Flaming Gorge Dam, but maybe down into certainly into Lodore and on the Yampa, Split Mountain ramifications up there, and then all the way down through the Grand Canyon.
Yeah, I think it would be interesting to hear if there's people that are interested in that there or not, or if here we're. Certainly those areas are impacted by rainfall and storm events, but
you bet.
Maybe not quite the extreme monsoonal driven stuff that we have here, but
it's funny because I think about wind events on Lake Mead and Lake Powell. the big reservoirs behind the big dams. So there's a number of interesting, kind of looking out spokes of the wheel from a central hub kind of concept here. Looking ahead now, where are you planning to do next with this program? Where or what are you planning to do next?
Well, the next phase is probably, well, we're going to do some follow-up from the workshop. We'll put together kind of in a bit of an informal document the outcome and the messages from the workshop, send that back to the participants, and probably include other people who are interested but couldn't make the workshop. And so they have a chance to take a look at the outcome and give us any additional feedback that maybe occurred afterwards. So that would be the immediate next step. I think for this specific project, we're expected to have something done by probably about next April, and by that time we would anticipate having a report that essentially recommends what be done. And it might be, I mean, some of these ideas maybe there'll be some progress on between now and then, but so this will, kind of prepare a report that has all these recommended steps or these possible next steps. And at the same time, I expect that the ones that people really prioritize the highest, we'll maybe put together into proposals. You know, if there are things that are going to cost money that somebody's going to have to invest in, we'll write whatever proposals need to be written to try and get the funding to implement those things. And so we expect to be doing that in that about that same time frame between now and next April.
Nice.
And then we also, this preliminary risk assessment I mentioned, our plan is to create kind of one of those online geo-narratives, or people call them story maps, so kind of a visual report of that kind of describes the setting and these risk maps we've created. So there'll be a something for folks to look at online that shows this.
Nice. Very nice. Kind of looking ahead in the crystal ball of the world, which is always difficult, is there any indication that the frequency of debris flows or flash floods or rain on cliffs causing rock falls, any sort of water-on-rock events, is that frequency increasing as we look at increased Atlantic and Pacific Ocean temperatures, et cetera, with changes we're seeing in climate?
I mean, it's certainly reasonable hypothesis. I haven't seen any data showing that.
Okay.
I haven't actually looked for any data showing that yet either.
Okay.
That would be something that would be a potential sort of research project to do offshooting from this, because that's a really good question. And I think, some people might say they think there is. I'm not sure if there's any conclusion on that yet, but certainly be very interested in that too.
Right. I mean, I'm just thinking about 1923. Today, 100 years ago, the USGS was on a river trip in the Grand Canyon, and actually, today is the 21st. I missed that. It was, I think, the 19th.
Oh. It
had been 2 days ago. Was the Little Colorado River flood, which was after a heavy monsoon summer, a real nice Pacific cyclone came in and just inundated an area that was already very wet, and off the system went. So, I haven't seen anything like it for 100 years, but there it was. So it's interesting to ponder these things. And if the frequency is definitely looking to be on the increase, then the risk is going to be increasing as well. And there is really no place safe during these events.
Yeah.
So,
Potentially, these events have happened. We know that they've definitely have always occurred down there. But it's a good question whether the frequency is increasing or not.
Right. Well, it would be good to stay ahead of that one, especially if it is. Brilliant. Anything else that you want to bring in that I haven't asked you about?
Well, it seems like we covered quite a bit. I can't think of anything. I think hopefully this results in something that that visitors to the canyon, not just boaters but hikers, anybody visiting the area, can find a little bit useful.
You bet. Absolutely. Paul Grahams, thank you so very, very much for participating in this V-Wave podcast today. I really appreciate it, and I wish you all the best with this project.
All right. Thanks again. Thanks for having, and thanks for the interest.
You're welcome.